And now I would like to introduce our main speaker for the evening, Stephen from San Diego.
My name's Stephen, and I'm an alcoholic. And I know a lot of you, which is really neat. I'd like to start with congratulating Ron on 9 years. Where are you at, buddy? Congratulations, man. That's really awesome. I've got to share that with you, and that's part of the gift of this program. Newcomers, you know, you're the lifeblood of this program. Without you, I would not be here today. So please keep coming back. I'd like to thank Al and Felix for asking me to come up here and get vulnerable. Because that's what it is. You know, I'm not standing up here because I want you guys to like me. I'm standing up here because it's a service call. You know, and so here we go. We got any Al-Anons in here tonight? Any bold enough to raise your hand? 1, 2. Oh, come on. We're a little honest here. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Okay, so we got about 100, but only 12 will show. I'm a double winner, and you guys will enjoy that because later on I'm going to tell you somewhere in there, remind me to tell you a story about a prayer fight I got in with an Al-Anon woman, and she kicked my bleeping butt. She won. Actually, I won. But remind me if I don't. It's only about a 15-second story. Now it's longer now. I was born Stephen Michael Green here in La Mesa in Grossmont Hospital. I have an older sister named Laura. I have a younger sister named Sharon. My mother was 18 by the three of us. By the time the three of us were born, so we basically had a child for a mother raising three children. I have a picture at home. It's very dear to me, and when I see it, I see a child holding three babies. My father left when I was about three. I never met him. There's a whole bunch that goes along with that. About a year and a half later, my mother remarried an Italian man, and they had a daughter. And so that's 1966, and there's four of us. I got three sisters and me. And my sponsor said I had to wear this, but Ben said I didn't, so. Don't listen to my sponsor. I'll pass out if I don't take this thing. I can't breathe. So in 1966, there's four of us, and I have an Italian father, and he's 6'1", and he's got dark black hair, and he's got big bones and olive skin and hands that look like a basketball player's hands. And when he taught me how to play catch, he was left-handed. And you know, if you're a little kid and you learn how to catch baseball from a left-handed Italian, there's no such thing as subtle, soft, or easy. It was just a knuckleball that went like this, and it just amazed me. And that was my whole experience with my father. And I'll refer to my second father as my father. My biological father just hung out for a couple of years, fathered three kids, and left. There's some story that goes along with him. It's sad, and I'm glad I didn't have to have that experience. I grew up right here in La Mesa. I'd like to tell you that there was only four kids involved in that, but there were a lot more. My father had two other wives with three other sons by the age of 24. So when he married my mother, there were three other sons, became my brothers, and then the four of us made seven. And then my father, the one that he married in Seattle, had another husband and a son, so I had another once removed half brother. And then the first wife of my father, when he left, another man came in, and she had a daughter who was my once removed half sister. So now there's nine of us. Okay. And I could not, you know, it's like the title of this is, you just can't get there from here. Okay, that's what's stuck in my mind. You know, I'm a little kid, and I got three Italian brothers, and I got an older sister that wants to be an only child. I don't know if you've experienced that, but she kicked the living daylight out of me on a daily basis. She wanted to be an only child, and she didn't get to be an only child. She had three other half brothers and a half sister once removed, and a half brother in Seattle, and we were an enmeshment of I think it's three moms and four dads and nine kids, you know, and I just couldn't get it. I was one of the slow kids. Okay, I'm not saying I'm stupid. I'm ignorant, but I'm not stupid. But I was slow. You know, and now today I think they call it mentally challenged, or, you know, they have all kinds of names and titles, and they give you drugs and all kinds of stuff. Back then they just said, he's slow, he's okay, leave him alone. You know, and they put Forrest Gump would be a good relation to what I was like. I kid you not. You know, they put leg braces on me, and they put glasses on me, and they sent me... early school, and they sent me to, what do you call them? I don't know, some kind of counselor or something. I'd go to this guy's house, and he would drop a dollar bill between my fingers. And he would just set it there, and he'd say, ready? And I'd go, yeah, and he'd drop it, and I'd try to catch it. And I literally couldn't catch it. I mean, I got a dog at home. It's a yellow lab, and it's just the most awesome dog you've ever met. But it is just a dumb dog. You know, it's just happy, it's dumb. I got a female that just is amazingly smart, just runs the whole show. When he pees, she barks at him. I yell at him, she yells at him. You know, and I'm like that dog. I mean, I was just this slow, dumb, happy to be a kid. And I just didn't fit in, you know, and I couldn't understand. You know, I look at my dad, and my dad's 6 foot tall, 6'1", he's dark haired, big boned Italian. I'm thinking, someday I'm going to be like him. You know, because I didn't know he wasn't my real father. They changed the birth certificate. He adopted me. He gave me his name along with my sisters. And I found out at the age of seven, my stepbrother came down and I don't know if you guys have ever had this kind of relationship, but we were a couple angry kids at 6 and 7. I think he was maybe a year older, and he was angry that his dad lived with me, and you know, and nobody had any way of communicating, because if you ever lived in an Italian family, you only got two emotions, and that's, you know, pissed off and happy. That's all you get. And so my brother comes down from Seattle. I'm about 7 or 8, and we're literally just beating the tar out of each other. That was our bonding when we met. You know, we would just black and blue each other until somebody picks up a hammer and, you know, wanted to get the last shot in. And his way of getting back was, you're not even his real son. So my parents prescribed to a method that what you didn't know wouldn't hurt you. You know, so that insanity is pretty much insanity. That's like getting a really bad wound and leaving the dirt and just throwing a bandage over it, you know, and then when the arm gets gangrene, you just cut it off. That was kind of the philosophy that my parents taught, you know, or what I grew up in. And so that just floored me. At 8 years old, I'm thinking, okay, I'm trying to put my mind around nine kids and where I fit in. And I told you, you can't get there from here. And that just blew the doors off. I didn't trust anybody. I was angry. I was hurt. My parents were workaholics. They're both practicing alcoholics to this day. And it's an Italian family. You know, everybody's. I can remember being in a Catholic school in Lemon Grove. There used to be an old Ace Theater over there. And I'm at St. John of the Cross, so I'm a little kid, and I'm dressing up in white shirts and green pants, and, you know, we got our little, whatever you call it, uniform. And I wasn't going to share this, but I guess I don't get to pick what I share. I'm a little kid playing basketball, and I hear a little voice. And I know all about God and Jesus Christ and religion. I go to Mass. You know, I'm in a Catholic school. So I know all about confession and the whole deal. I'm in sixth grade, fifth grade, going through this thing, and I hear a basketball goes way over in the corner, and I go to get it, and I hear a still quiet voice, and the still quiet voice says, "Give me your life." I'm like, "What?" I'm looking around for a father, a nun, a friend, and I thought, that's really strange. And I started to walk away. I heard a voice, and it said, "Give me your life." And I'm like, okay. Now I'm really looking around, and I know who it is, okay? And I hear it a third time. Peter heard the same voice three times. I heard the voice again, and I looked at him, and I looked at him, stared up at the cross or whatever, a little kid, and I said, "No, I want to drink, and I want to smoke, and I want to have sex, and I want to laugh, and I want to do all the things that I see people doing with so much abundance. All my uncles and aunts and cousins and the weddings and the poker games and everything that's going on. I want to be like my dad. I want to look at Playboy and Penthouse and think, yeah, I just read the articles." And I said, no. And, I went on a wild ride. And I can remember just so much insanity and just not fitting anywhere in that family. And my uncle went away to Lone Park for a couple of years. IRS got a hold of him. Couldn't catch him for anything else. So the Italians, they always give for money. So they sent him up north for a couple of years. My mom and dad went down to the Continental for a couple of years. And they were gone. I mean, we're 7, 8, 9. Me and got three sisters at home. My parents are gone for 2 years. And we got aunts and uncles, and we got Dannies, and we got babysitters, and, you know, and we always had a stock bar. It was an Italian house. You know, there was always a reason to drink. So we started drinking, you know, and I can remember taking that drink and feeling for the first time in my life, okay. You know, I don't remember if I got sick. I don't remember about nothing. I remember a whole bunch of other people trying it, but my reaction was different. This works. You know, and I just kept on doing it, and I started drinking more, and then I started smoking marijuana, and I'm in seventh grade, and I can't make sense of anything, because all I want to do is drink and get stoned. I just want to get away from reality, because nothing makes any sense to me. I got a dad I've never met. Tried asking about my biological father, and it hurt my real dad's feelings, so I stopped asking questions. And so we never talked about Donald, my biological father. And that was me growing up. You know, it was just insanity. And when I found drugs and alcohol, it was like the first time I laughed. You know, I can remember drinking and getting stoned and not feeling like I was playing with those effing four horsemen. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. I lived with those horses all of my life. Those are the horses that I played with as a child. And, you know, when I drank and I use drugs or whatever I could stuff into my body to just get me out of reality for just a little period. This is seventh grade, you know? And see, my dad quit school at ninth grade. His dad had passed away, and he went to work, and he's a self-made millionaire by the age of 25. And I wanted to follow in my dad's footsteps. And I left school. They passed me through eighth. I went to Monta Vista a couple semesters in ninth grade, and that was it. You know, that was back when they were bussing in, you know, all the different, you know, you couldn't just have one people. You couldn't have just Mexicans or blacks or whites. You had to take them from, you know, the south and the north and the west, and you had to bring them all around. And you know what? That was a pretty big mess. You know, there was people getting hurt and there was people fighting, and Monta Vista was not a fun place to be. And I'm a little white kid, you know, and I just I couldn't go there. So I went to work at age 12, 13. You know that thing the government sends you out? It shows you the money you've paid into Social Security. I think the first year I paid into Social Security, I was 12 years old. So I'm already washing dishes and, you know, I'm working my way up through the ranks and. Because my parents own Italian restaurants, so I'm washing dishes, and then I'm going to the prep cook, and then I'm going to the cook, and then I'm, you know, and I'm working my way up, and God, I didn't have this in my story at all. You know, I'm running a couple of stores and I am just drinking. I'm 20 years old and I am just drinking and drugging and I'm killing myself, you know, and everybody around me is going with me. You know, we're all jails and institutions, and I mean, I in the front seat of cop cars. I remember being, we went out to a party, got so tore up, and it was the next day, and I'm driving home. The guy pulls me over and he goes, "You're drunk." I go, "That was last night. I'm not drunk." He goes, "You're still drunk." I go, "It's another day. Don't you get it? That was last night." He puts me in the front of the car, and I'm trying to get his attention, so I'm smacking the windshield with my foot, and the windshield spiders. Well, alcoholic mind that I have is like, fuck it, he's going to get pissed at... I'm sorry. I didn't want to do that. I have a really bad mouth. let me rephrase that. I was afraid he's going to find out anyway, so I pushed the thing out. I put my feet up and I pushed the whole windshield out. And they're not too fond of that kind of stuff. So, you know, that's when they hit you real hard right across here. And they flip you over and they make you look like a tied up pig, and you know, then they drag you in the room and they bang you around a little bit. I guess they like their cop cars. I don't know what the deal is on that, but man, I never did that again. That was a. a little bit more drunk along, and then I'm gonna move along. What time am I? 8? 9 o'clock I'm out? Jimmy? 9? I got to get sober here pretty quick, don't I? No. It's bad. I'm drinking. I was never a good drinker. I was always, you know, I'm 5'4" and it would put alcohol in me, and I was 6 foot. I'd fight anybody, and I just didn't care. I was like David, you know. I had places to go and people to fight, you know. And my friends knew, you know, when I got drunk, it was just. I think they would just follow me around to see what was going to happen. And so one night, I'll just tell you a couple of the drunk alongs. I'm Lemon Grove, across from an AC Theater, closed the place up. 20 years old, I got access to beer and wine 24 hours a day, two different stores. And I wake up the next morning at home and I get dressed and I go out to my car and the whole side of my car is just wasted. Doorknobs are gone. And I'm thinking, somebody wrecked my car. Well, I didn't have time to worry about it. I got in, driving to work, and as I'm driving to work, I'm driving and I see parts of my car on the road. And I'm thinking, it flashback. You guys ever have that? Flashback start coming. Doot, 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 doot. It's like little clips of what you did the night before. I'm like, oh my God, and I'm thinking I'm driving to work and my dad's going to, I just got the car from my aunt because something happened to the other one and he's keeping a close eye on me, and you know, and I'm like, I take it to Lemon Grove Auto Body and I run to work and I got to hide it, you know, I'm paying cash to the guy at Lemon Grove Auto Body to get the car fixed, but you know what had happened is I was blind drunk, came home, caught the metal wire that holds a telephone pole and just ripped the whole side of my, and drove home and parked it in the front of my house. Forgot all about it. And I can literally tell you there are hundreds of insane blackout stories that happen in a span from 12 to 24. And I'm not going to go into anymore. I was a blackout drinker. I should be dead. There's really only one reason that I'm standing here, because I think God's got something he wants me to do. You know, so I suit up, I show up, and I do it. And It's Al-Anon, it's Alcoholics Anonymous, and I ran in. This is the story about the Al-Anon. We had a little prayer, and she won. I'll tell you that later. Everybody's got. I want to hear that one. So okay. Let's see. I'm gonna go ahead and move on to getting sober. Okay, you guys don't want to hear any more drunk along, do you? They don't want to hear drunk along. 24 years old, I end up in a Sweetwater, I end up in a little trailer isolated, right? Because this is what happens on Thursday night where I live. I'm living with a crystal dealer over by Monta Vista High School. I'm 24 years old. And Wednesday night, he'd say, come on, let's do something. I'm trying not to drink and I'm trying to hold down a construction job. I'm trying to do something right with my life. And uh, And Johnny was in a wheelchair, and he had a spinal injury. And, you know, the only thing that he enjoyed was squirt guns and crystal. And he was really good with a squirt gun. He was fun to play with. And talking about grown men, or boys, I guess. You know, and he would say, do you want to do a line 15 times? And I'd say no 14 times. And he always won. You know, and it was a vicious cycle. And we would party Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And I wouldn't show up to work on Monday. And Tuesday, I'd go to get my job back. And, you know, the foreman would look at me like, you know, because we have a tendency to be good at what we do. We do. I'm not talking about ego. I'm just saying alcoholics, we are good at the gifts we have. You know, when we're not drinking, we're not using. So they always hired me back. But I ended up at 24. I'm in this trailer at Sweetwater, and I go. I had gotten away from Johnny. I couldn't hang out with the old group because I knew it was insanity. You know, it was just a cycle that was going on. You know, drinking, drugging, and I was dying. So I moved into this little trailer by myself, and I was leaving my house to go to work one day, and I hit the gate, and I couldn't open the gate. I was terrified of opening the gate. I know they have a medical term for that. I have no idea what it is. All I know is that terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair had come back to play. And I'm staring at this little white picket gate, and I couldn't open the gate. I knew if I went out the gate, I was going to drink, I was going to drug, I was going to die. And my sister had gotten this program. My mom had gotten this program about a year before. And I called my mom, and my mom said, they lied to me. They said, you want to go, because I had caught golf fever about 10 years ago. They go, you want to go to Arizona and play golf? I'm like, yeah. You know, and they sent me to Wickenburg, Arizona. It's a treatment center. Pia and Pat Melody. And oh, my God. It's an hour out in the middle of a wash, out in the middle of nowhere in the Arizona mountains. And they dropped me off. And it was, you know, my dad was kind enough to pay for it. It was really expensive. But when I stepped foot on the property, they said, if you leave, you're the one that owes the $30,000. You know, and I'm like, I don't want to be here. You know, I do not want to be here. And it was a eight-week program, and I was there 3 months. So that kind of slow kid, you know, I've never really lost that slow kid, you know. I'm like that 40-1 shot, you know. Every now and then we're there at the end, but usually we're just quick out of the gate. Is that what it is? I don't know, something like that. I'm in Wickenburg, Arizona, and I got this little blue jacket on. You got to have this little blue jacket on for 72 hours because you're a suicide risk. So I spend 3 months in this treatment center, and they all became my family. I mean, I'm going to counseling twice a day. I'm bunking with eight guys. There's 60 guys in the community, and we all got colors, and there's six tables and 10 people at a table, and a newcomer comes in and an old member leaves. You know, and that cycle, it was only supposed to be a 6 to 8 week cycle. And that cycle was 12 weeks for me. And that's where I dealt with a lot of stuff. You know, I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got introduced to Al-Anon and codependency. I had two alcoholic parents, a mother and father. My mother went back to drinking. My sister went back to drinking. My dad's never tried to stop. My whole family's affected by the disease in one form or another. And I got 3 months reprieve to get transparent, to do my fourth and fifth step, to look at sixth and seventh and make a list. And then that power greater than myself. You know, that was just, that's all the difference in the world. I wasn't alone anymore. Not only was I freed of all of the stuff that had been killing me my whole life, you know, I still at that point hadn't made a whole lot of sense out of the three mothers, four fathers, and nine kids. Even to this day, I still have trouble with that. I left the treatment center. I think there was one story I wanted to share in the treatment center. There's probably more than one. So 12 weeks in the treatment center, I came back, and the first meeting I went to was Saturday Night Survivors at the senior center across from Porter Hall in La Mesa. I was 24 years old, and I walked in, and I sat down on my hands on my hands and I was crying, and I'm looking around the room, and there's nobody under 50. I mean, everybody in there is just gray haired and old and a lot like Jimmy, you know, just Jimmy's my sponsor, so I'm just getting even. I walked in, I sat down, this lady looks over, she leans over to me, and I'm crying, and I'm feeling ashamed and embarrassed because I'm crying, and I'm a man and a boy. And she says, "We'll love you until you learn to love yourself." And I knew it was home. You know, nobody really cared that I was crying. Nobody made an issue about it. Everybody shared, and I felt at home. You know, and the thing I wanted to share about leaving Wickenburg, Arizona, was that my counselor came up to me, and he said, "Stephen, you've already experienced jails. You've already experienced institutions." And I didn't even go into all the institutions that I've been in, the wallets I made and the copper engraving and you know, the bowling with pads on. And, you know, he looked at me and he said, he goes, "You know, you already experienced jails. You already experienced institutions." He goes, "I'm afraid to tell you, but it's the truth." He goes, "The only thing that's left out there for you is death." He goes, "If you go back out and you get back with the same crowd, you're going to die." And he didn't say any other word. You know, so when I came back, I was ready to do 90 meetings in 90 days. See, when I got out of the treatment center, you guys, I was there 3 months. You know, they just would not let me go. I was the host at a family thing, and I did it so badly. I think I walked up and I was like, "My name's Stephen." I had so much shame and guilt and fear that I couldn't even talk. I mean, they made me do it twice. And, you know, it's like they had guards on me. "Raise your chin up. Speak up." You know, like, "Tink, bark, rah, 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 rah. Wear a suit and tie, rah, rah, rah," you know. So I came back, and you know what? I had done a lot of work. You know, I had worked the steps. I had a power greater than myself. I had a sponsor. I got a sponsor immediately. My sponsor's name is Tim Moran. His wife's name is Ann, and they're just the most neatest people in the world. We spent 5 years together, man. I swear I was glued to his hip for 5 years. He had a couple of days less sobriety than I did, but that was my little boast. You know, he came in a couple of days behind me, but he was a master chief in the Navy, and he's about 10 or 12 years older than me. And I just love that man. As far as I know, he's down in Florida with Ann. I haven't talked to him in a while. He was having some throat cancer problems. I pray he's okay. His sponsor was Steve Knight. And so we went to Friday night men's, you know, religiously every Friday. We're at Friday night men's, and that was a tough place to get sober. Saturday night survivors, Friday night men's. I grew up in Levin Grove Alano Club, you know, mustering the courage to walk in up on, they got a platform and a stage, and everybody looks at you. And you know what? I mean, I love that place. You know, to me, Levin Grove Alano Club is home. And I just started doing what they said. You know, I started making coffee. They said, "Show up." Tim said, "Show up early and stay late." None of it made any sense to me, but in a sense, I was lucky because I was one of those slow guys. You know, I've seen a lot of people come in this program too smart for it, you know, but I've never seen anybody come in too stupid. So I grab a hold of that, and, you know, I'm okay with being slow. Stupid, if that's what it is. If that keeps me in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm okay with that. You know, and that was June 1, 1986. And I haven't had a drink in that whole period of time. I don't take medications. Randy and I were just talking. Where'd you go, Randy? Did he leave?
He went home sick.
He went home sick. Randy and I were talking last week. I was passing some kidney stones, and oh, my God. I mean, if you've ever had that happen, it's brutal. There's a whole new understanding of "this too shall pass." But, okay, now here's the mental thing. Where was I? You know, sobriety in the first 5 years with Tim was amazing. Just the family and the camaraderie and the going to places and the fitting in and having dealt with all of the horrors and the histories and, you know, all the things that I was stuffing. It really takes a ton of energy to stuff all that shame and guilt and remorse and pain and hurt and sadness. It took all of my life force on a daily basis to block that out. You know? And when I got to open up and just put it all out there in front of somebody, and they looked at me and they say, "Hey, you know what? I've done the same thing. You know? I'm just like you. And I fit in for the first time in my life." So Alcoholics Anonymous is where I grew up. I was 24 when I walked in. I'm 46 now. And it might sound strange, but you know what I'm really hoping for? And I really, whether I get it or not, it's a goal. I mean, I guess everybody has goals about being something or doing something or achieving something. But my goal is, I'm 46, I'll be 47 in February. If I can just keep doing this deal, and I think I can. You know, if I can just keep working with newcomers and commitments and being responsible to carry the message to anybody who needs Alcoholics Anonymous. When I hit 50, I'll have a 25-year chip in my pocket. You know? And I'll never be a college graduate. You know, I'll never be a master mechanic. I'll never fly airplanes. I'll never... There's a whole list of things that this kid's never going to do. But, you know, that's like the... That's just one kind of goal in my life. You know, I want a 25-year token on my 50th birthday. You know, now I'll tell you what I'm really passionate about. I'm really passionate about two little girls that were born in this program. My wife Tammy is sitting... Stand up. My wife Tammy is... Stand up. We got together and... God, how do I do this? Okay, it was just straight on honesty. In 1990, I was divorcing my first wife, amazing woman. We were kids. We were together 8 years, and we thought a couple left-hand rings would make everything all right. And we spent 2 years together, and Barb and I divorced, you know, because that doesn't work, you know. And she's the neatest woman, and my wife and I were all friends. But I met Tammy at Cass Street Alano Club in 1990, and she helped me divorce my first wife, Barbara. I met Tammy when I was 14 years old. We were living out of Granite Hills, and her cousin Kevin used to come across and buy weed from me all the time. Because I'm just one of them kids that, you know, I didn't know a whole lot, but I knew if you took seed and you threw it in the ground and horse fertilizer and a little water and God put sun and water on it, you know, it just bushes. You know, my mom had thoroughbred horses. The ones that race. The expensive ones. And they're out there eating all kind of Colombian weeds and just, you know, and I'm just, you know, and I just don't give a crap. You know, I'm 14 years old, and her cousin and her come across the street one Easter, and I got, you know, I got half a dozen plants drying out in my little fort that, you know, I live in the back by the horses, because that's where my parents tolerated me at. Her and Kevin come over. So I met this woman when I was 14 years old. I didn't see her again until 1990. That's a real God thing. She helped me get, like I said, she helped me divorce my first wife. We had a daughter, Tara, in 91. We had a daughter, Tori, in 93. Things are really hard. If you got kids, you know that. We were both working parents, and she was going for a new job, and I was struggling, and we got two screaming kids, and she has a 10-year-old son at the time when we met, which was almost a deal breaker for me, you know, because he was hard boiled. You know, he had seen a couple of different dads, and he wouldn't take any suggestions or any commands or orders or nothing from me. But, you know, we got through that. But we divorced in 96. She decided, you know, she just never really had a chance to go play. She had a son when she was 16 or 17, and she'd been raising him. And we divorced. She wanted to do some living, and I couldn't agree with her living lifestyle. So I divorced her, and I went to church. And I'm going to Al-Anon meetings. And I'm going to this Al-Anon meeting, and this I love the women in Al-Anon. Not real fond of the men. That's my own personal issue. I love the women in Al-Anon. And we get outside of an Al-Anon meeting one night, and we're sitting there. And see, this, I'm 10 years sober, and the concept I have of God is a loving God. I got it here at Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it's G-O-D. It's good orderly direction. You know, it's the group. It's electricity. All you got to do is walk over, throw the switch, and it works. You don't have to know how it works. It just works. And I'm 10 years sober, and I'm going through a divorce with Tammy, and me and this Al-Anon get together, and we start talking, and she starts telling me about Jesus Christ and the Holy Spirit and salvation and God and everything that goes along with the 66 books that are penned by 40 different authors over 1,500 years. And, you know, I'm like, you know, I'm that contempt prior to investigation. You know, I got the gates down. I'm not hearing nothing. And my last words were, I'll pray for you that you have an awakening that God of AA shows you that there's no hell. She looks at me and she fires back. And I'm going to pray for you that you understand the totality of Jesus Christ. And I'm like, have a nice day. The book of Job is a man who has everything stripped away from him. I'm tired with it. He's just doing nothing, minding his own business. His wife's there. He's having dinner, and his servant comes running in. He says, Job, the Hittites just stole all your animals. You know, that's wealth. Before that servant could stop talking, another one comes in. And he says, Job, they just stole all of your grain and food. And before that one stops, another servant comes running in. And Job's sitting there, what the heck? And the servant says, you know, there was an earthquake or a lightning strike, and all of your sons and daughters and grandchildren, they all died. So within a few minutes and three or four different servants running into Job's house, he hears all of this bad news. Okay, well, that's what happened to me. I was going through a divorce with Tammy. In a short period of time, I was going through a divorce with Tammy. My 69 custom van got stolen. I was 20 grand upside down in credit cards. I lost my job. I'm sitting in a little place off Aztec Drive, and a little still voice is saying, why don't you go jump off the Coronado Bridge? You know, and then I prayed that night and prayed for that Al-Anon lady that she would get a clue. And you know, if I'm not trying to run you off, if I was in this program for 10 years, and if anybody ever mentioned the word church, Christianity, Christ, any of that, bam, I got earplugs. I think I still carry those for my bike. Bam. I would go, bam, don't want to hear it. God of God, He works fine. Leave me the hell alone. But I got saved. I ended up calling a cousin, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on that, but I got saved. I went to a Greg Laurie Harvest Crusade, received Jesus Christ, my Lord and Savior. We're divorced. We're divorced about a year, and I'm sitting in front of Mike McIntosh up at Horizons. I'm sitting in front of Mike, and Mike, he's not talking to me. There's 500 in the congregation. And Mike looks down at me, and he says, go back to your wife and tell them the Holy Spirit can heal your marriage. I'm like, see, I'm in AA for 10 years, so I take suggestions really well. I didn't even think about it. You know, I just went and bought her a woman's devotional Bible. I took it up to Geico, and she had an armed posse around her. I was a little angry in the divorce. A couple of cars got destroyed. But I thought that was growth. You know, I'm thinking, hey, it's not suicide or homicide. It's just metal, glass, and plastic. You know, I'm thinking, we could get new ones of those. Remember that, honey? Yeah. I wasn't going to share this either. Oh, God, I got a couple of minutes. So I take her a devotional Bible, and she's like, get the fuck out of here. And I leave, you know, and I'm going to Foothills, and Mark and David are praying for us. There's 5,000 people there. I'm at Mike's place up at Horizons. There's 10,000 people praying for us up there. I'm at Ray Bentley's church. I'm at Park 6 and Fur, eating with the homeless and praying, and everybody was praying. And I asked her to go to a shaking her head. Don't share that. I asked her to go to a Crystal Lewis concert, and she canceled on me. So she came to a sermon the next week, and you'll have to ask her what the sermon was about. But the Holy Spirit, right in front of my eyes, Miles was doing a sermon at 7 o'clock when he was a youth pastor up there. And she came in and she sat down, and after 40 minutes of the Holy Spirit coming out of Miles McPherson, she got saved. I mean, I literally got to watch the Holy Spirit reach into her heart and take out a heart of stone and put a heart of a pure heart of kindness and goodness and life, you know. And she's not the same person I knew. And that was 12 years ago. So we've been together 18 years, and we've had some highs and we've had some lows. And the kids have one mom. See, my kids got there from here. My kids have one mom and one dad. You know, like I said, we got remarried. Maybe I didn't. She got saved. We got remarried a year later, and we've been together ever since then. And you know, that's Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, if I don't sober up, I don't take suggestions, and I don't take her a Bible, and I don't ask her to come to church, it just doesn't happen. You know, so what I firmly believe here is that I grew up here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a really good friend of mine. His name is Andrew. He's a young man, and he has no idea that he has kept me sober for how long. You been sober?
1 year.
He's kept me sober for over a year. You know, another buddy of mine, Stuart, he's kept me sober, and the newcomers in this program. I wasn't kidding when I said, without you, I'm dead. You know, you're the lifeblood of Alcoholics Anonymous. And without you, I have no purpose here. So please keep coming back. I apologize. I'm not going to apologize. Bill and Bob talk about in We Agnostics, you know, that we never apologize for our Creator. So whether it's good orderly direction, whether it's electricity, you know, whether you just follow in the footsteps of your sponsor that's gone before you and follow direction, whatever it is, that just happens to be my story. Whether to me it's good. I've got a beautiful family, and I'll share, and I'll close with this. My passion is this. I want to grow old and I want to die with this woman. I want my kids to see a mom and dad finish the race. I want to see my grandkids not be confused by four different mothers and five different husbands and nine children from different races and backgrounds, you know. I know it happens, and I know God wanted me to have that experience. Nothing happens, absolutely nothing happens in God's world by mistake. You know? So maybe there's somebody out there that's going to hear me and go, you know what, I can relate to that. My dad left. And that's my passion. My passion is my family. You know, I love my wife. I love my daughters. I'm struggling with their boyfriends. My biological, there's just a couple of minutes. My biological father, I believe, was a full alcoholic, and he put a gun in his mouth when I was 12 years old and took his life. My father came in that night, and I said, Dad, why is Mom crying? And see, I had tried to ask my dad about my biological father and hurt his feelings. So I stopped. But that night he came in, and he was crying, and I had never seen him cry before. You know, he's an old school Italian and they don't cry. And he was crying, and it scared me. And I said, why are you crying? And he said, your dad just killed himself. And I comforted him that night. You know, I comforted him. I said, it's all right, Dad. It's all right, Dad. Mom will be all right. It's okay. I never knew the man. It's hard to grieve over someone. And I... There's some weird parts of this story. When I was in recovery at 24 years, I had never seen the man. I had an identity problem. I didn't know. When I looked out, you guys saw, my dad was 6'1", olive skin, Italian, big hands, big bone, and I just didn't match anybody. I found that I had a grandfather in Phoenix and an aunt in Indianapolis, and they sent me pictures, and I was about 2 months sober, and I got these pictures, and I'm sitting at this treatment center, and I'm a couple months clean, working the steps, and I open up these pictures, and I pull out this picture, and there's a picture of me sitting on the rim of the Grand Canyon. And that was my biological father. And I met my grandfather that year. He came and picked me up, my biological grandfather. And I got to spend a couple of years with him before cancer took him home. And the last remaining family member on that side, my two other uncles killed themselves. And there's rumors about aunts and everybody being in the mental institution. So I'm pretty sure that's what would have happened to me had I not found Alcoholics Anonymous. And the last thing I'm going to share is this. My aunt lost three brothers that all suicided. But she found out she had me, and I'm the only member of her family left. And she came out here in a visit and scared to death. She took a risk. She called me up, and I said, I want to meet you, and I promise I won't kill myself. I forgot that promise. When I met her, it was at an airport, and our daughter was 8 or 9 months old, I think. And I handed my daughter, Tara, to my Aunt Susie, and I said, here. You can't leave. And she didn't. She went, packed everything up, and moved here. And, you know, and that's a blessing of Alcoholics Anonymous. So thanks for listening.